Welcome to the 10-12, the podcast that covers all 10 teams in the Big 12 Conference. I'm your host, Philip Slavin. Thank you for joining us today. This episode is Lehoe the Head. Oh my God, I hate when I do stuff like this. It's so embarrassing. Okay, don't do that again. Philip, don't do it. It is loaded. It is chock full of so much good stuff. I've got two super regional previews. One with our good friend Keith Patrick from Dinger Derby. We're talking about Texas Tech and their super regional against Stanford this weekend. Then Nathan Bond of the Daily Stampede covers South Florida is going to join us to talk about the Austin super regional, South Florida facing off against Texas in Austin this weekend. Two Big 12 teams with a shot at the College World Series. Two Big 12 teams I both think will be in Omaha this year. I'm good about that. And we're going to lead the show off our three guest lineup with Linda Godfrey with Fantasy Football Confidential. We're going to talk about fantasy drafting Big 12 players. I do this interview every year with somebody. I do this bit every year, and no one ever cares, and I don't care. It's my show. I'm going to do it. A couple of quick business things for you to be aware of. First off, right now we are trying to do a little something. We're trying to get the 1012 Twitter account up to 1,000 followers. It's 1012 Podcast, T-E-N, the number 12 of the word podcast. As of recording this, we're up to 979. Put a little ask out to try and get to 1,000 by Friday. We've had a nice rise in the follower count. So if you listen to the show and are on Twitter and don't follow us yet, go give us a follow on Twitter. We would appreciate it. No, there's no prize for doing so. It's just a nice thing to do for us. Leave us a rating and a review. 5 stars, please, if you can leave a review, especially on iTunes. It really does help us out. I understand iTunes is a pain in the butt, but it does benefit the show if you can do so. Yeah, I would appreciate it. A few things in the works for the 1012 this summer that I'm very excited about. I can't give you a lot of details, but we've got some things coming. The month of July, just so you're aware, is going to be a little bit light. We're probably not going to have any Monday episodes in July. We're just going to take those off. We are working to be at Big 12 Media Days. We were there in the past. We're going to try and do so again this year. It's July. There are no collegiate sports going on. Baseball will be ending soon. Softball will end today, Thursday, if you're listening to this, the day it goes up, Oklahoma and Florida State, Game 3, 2 p.m., God's time, Central time, to find out who's going to win the softball national championship, who will win the Women's College World Series. That's today. Track and field national championship is underway in Eugene, Oregon. So 2020-2021 college sports year is almost done. So, of course, in July, we're going to take a little bit of a break. We've got a little planning to do, some things that we're working on that I'm very excited about. So, yes, we know about the playoff news. Yes, we know about the 12-team being the lead thing. Yes, we have talked about the 12-team playoff on this show before. I am for it. I am an advocate of it. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole today. Lots of people are saying a lot of smart things. Go find some sports podcasts that are talking about the playoff expansion. You're getting a lot of different opinions. I am for it. I think it's the right thing for the sport. No, it's not the best way to find a champion. Maybe going back to 2 is not the worst thing, but I think 12 makes a lot of sense. We'll see if that's what actually happens. Yeah? Yeah. I know. Riveting stuff there. Riveting stuff. Before we get to our three guests, they are our longest running sponsor here on the podcast, and they are in the midst of one of the best things that happens in collegiate sport apparel anywhere at any time. It's home field apparel at Big New Saturday Season 2. Notre Dame last week was a huge success. LSU is coming up this week. Two Big 12 teams on the horizon. I know what they are. I want to tell you guys. I really do. I am very excited for you to find out. But I want you to make sure you know the promo code for when they pop up. That is 1012. T-E-N-1-2. That is going to get you 20% off your first order on the most comfortable vintage college sports apparel there is. It is my go-tos. They are my favorite t-shirts. They will be your favorite t-shirts. Not like if you follow them on Twitter, and you should follow Homefield Apparel on Twitter, on social media, Twitter especially, because that's where all the conversation gets going. Everything I always see of people is like, I buy so much stuff from them from schools I never cared about in my entire life, and I love it. It's amazing. They're wonderful. They have Oklahoma State and Texas Tech and Iowa State and Baylor. And beep! Just kidding. Two Big 12 schools coming. If you haven't bought yet, Remember the promo code 1012, T-E-N-1-2. All orders of $70 or more right now get free shipping. So if you don't care about the schools that are coming, you just haven't bought yet, maybe you're like, I got to update my summer wardrobe. It's getting hot. I need some new tees. Homefieldapparel.com. Promo code 1012. And be rocking in the most comfortable, coolest, most awesomest, most just, what are you wearing that I want one? Vintage college sports apparel today. All right. Three great guests. We're talking fantasy drafting Big 12 players. We're previewing both Super Regionals. We've got a lot to get to. I'm pumped about this episode. Let's get to it.
Hey guys, Christine Butterfield here.
And Madison Morris. And together we host the Winning Women Podcast.
This podcast is all about women's empowerment and creating a positive platform for females to tell their stories.
Each week, we interview players, coaches, reporters, journalists, and much, much more. The conversations we have are unique to each guest, and they always have words of wisdom to share.
Listen to the Winning Women podcast on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, presented by the Highball Network.
All right, this is one of my favorite interviews to do every year. No one cares, but I do, and I'm going to do it every year just because I enjoy it, and it's my show, so meh. We are talking about fantasy drafting Big 12 players. And we're going to talk about some of the rookies that just got drafted here in the 2021 draft and some of the guys who've been in the league for a couple of years. We're not going to get into the veterans. I'm more interested in the year two and year three guys. And I'm very excited to have Linda Godfrey, a Fantasy Football Confidential, joining us today. Linda, welcome to the 1012.
Yeah, thanks. I'm excited to talk about it. So if nobody else listens, know that I will, and I will shamelessly pump it out to all my buddies to listen to as well. So
I'm putting this interview first in the podcast order, so people either have to like listen to it or skip all the way through it to get to the other stuff, because that's the kind of masochist I am. So as I'm preparing for this particular interview, I come to a really interesting observation. Now, the Big 12 had a few players draft second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth round. But as far as fantasy football goes, and let me just say this, I play redraft every year, and I have a couple of dynasty teams, so I like all different versions. I do not do Devy. Devy is the word I'm looking for, where you draft kids in college. Yeah. I don't do Devy. But by the way, if anyone has something like 16-team league, like, I would be happy to join. I'm weirdly interested in playing in a team where nobody has any talent, so then you have to actually be, like, really good at it. The point is, what the observation I made is you had a lot of offensive linemen and defensive players. All of the, like, fantasy football guys, yes, Sam Ellinger got drafted in the sixth round. Let's just set him aside. But all the, like, guys you would consider drafting in a startup or in redraft or just in a rookie draft all fell in the fourth round. Kenny Nwangu, running back from Iowa State to Minnesota. Ramondre Stevenson, running back from Oklahoma to New England. Chuba Hubbard, running back from Oklahoma State to Carolina. And, of course, Tylan Wallace, wide receiver from Oklahoma State to Baltimore. There's no one else. The list I'm pulling from is wrong, there's nobody else, which is a super weird thing. So, Linda, let's just start. We'll hit a couple of other guys just in how they relate to some other players. But let's just start here. Like, I know Iowa State fans like to brag that Nwangu got drafted before Stevenson and Chuba and all that. From a fantasy standpoint, nobody's.
No, and there's no reason to. That, it's Dalvin Cook and Dalvin Cook. And there's no reason to draft that. And by the time, like, especially in Dynasty, when you have the argument to take a player that might take some time to get to where you're, you know, drafting at a ceiling, when you're looking at draft capital, fourth round is not an excuse to let that person sit on your bench for 2 years to hopefully take over. So it's, he's pretty untouchable. I haven't seen him go. I'm in a lot of dynasty leagues. I've done probably 15 rookie drafts, and I don't know that I've seen him go any earlier than like the fourth round.
I've had one so far, and he didn't sniff anything weird. It's also an IDP league, and I don't want to get into that nonsense. IDP, whatever. And then plus, you know, behind Dalvin Cook, Alexander Madison's still there. Amir Abdullah. So, like, there's other guys who are there who have more experience you would expect to be a backup behind Dalvin Cook before Nwangu did. So, I don't – it was an interesting interesting pick there by Minnesota. Props to him. I hope he can make a name for himself there. We'll see. The other guys, let's go to Ramondre Stevenson, drafted by New England. I did have him drafted in my first rookie draft late, of course, late. But, I mean, let me just ask this as an overview. Of these four guys we're talking about, Nwangu, Stevenson, Hubbard, and Wallace, who does have the most value as far as if I'm doing a rookie draft? And let's go from that way. Let's say if you're a dynasty player and you're doing a rookie draft, or you're, and then if we're doing redraft, who has the most value here?
I think Chuba Hubbard, and I'm not, obviously I'm an Oklahoma State fan, so it comes across as a homer take, but New England Patriots backfield has a standard. That's a backfield you tend to avoid. Bill Belichick is not, he doesn't give a shit about your fantasy. Can I say that? He doesn't kill me.
Yeah.
He doesn't care about your fantasy team. So that's a backfield I tend to avoid anyway. And we saw what happened to Mike Davis last year when CMC got hurt. I mean, he skyrocketed. He had insane games. And when you look at that Carolina offense, Chuba is directly behind CMC. And there's no other guy that you want a rookie learning from than the best running back in the game right now. So I think Chuba has probably the most value right now in dynasty leagues.
Yeah. I forget the term, and forgive me, I'm supposed to know it. If you've got CMC, you're grabbing Chuba. Like, you're going to draft him. Handcuffing. Thank you. That's right. You're going to grab Chuba because you want to have the backup. It's a smart thing to do sometimes. I always like to try and grab the backups. Plus, I mean, I think with Carolina, we know McCaffrey's going to get all the carries and all the balls, but I still feel like they're going to give Chuba opportunities because they want to get him going. And they have talked about, like, he is the backup from day one. So, I'm not redraft. If you're just trying to grab somebody in the late rounds because you're just desperate, I get it. In fantasy or in dynasty, depending upon the size of your league, late second, early third feels like a good spot to get him, especially if you have CMC on your roster.
I like to take him so that people that have CMC on their roster can't take him. And I have implied that sentiment before. I love taking other people's handcuffs, especially when you can get them late, because then if they're RB1 goes down, you've got the answer. It's a fabulous place to be in.
Yes, it is. The other Oklahoma State player there, Tylan Wallace. Like, your opinion on New England Patriots running backs, I wholeheartedly agree with. It's also the same opinion I have on Baltimore Ravens wide receivers. I don't want any of them. There's too many talented guys there, and none of them are doing much of anything. Maybe Hollywood Brown's not talented. I don't know. But they also drafted Rondell Moore in this draft, so they added Moore and Wallace, and I just don't trust that passing game enough outside of Mark Andrews, the tight end, to say I've got to have a wide receiver from Baltimore. I will take a lot of other guys before I take a Baltimore wide receiver, because I think their best option is at best a wide receiver three on a team.
Yeah, it was Rashad Bateman, not Rondell Moore, the tiny, yes, tiny human who I wouldn't trust at all. But that's beside the point. We're not talking about him. Listen, I already had a lot of Tylan Wallace before the draft because I'm one of those degenerates that does startups with rookies prior to the draft happening, because you have to depend on what you see on tape and what you believe. And I really enjoy that, but it did land me with a lot of Tylan Wallace. And while I love him and I think he'll be great for the Raven football team, I do worry about production fantasy-wise, so I think he'll be great for Lamar Jackson. I think they'll do great together, but I do worry that fantasy production isn't going to be a thing. And like you said, Mark Andrews is really the only pass catching option on that team that I want a piece of.
Yeah. This was not a good, it's not a great draft for the Big 12 period, but it was not a good Big 12 draft as far as fantasy value goes. And that was a terrible landing spot for Tylan Wallace. Like, of all the places to go, that was not, was not ideal, especially for lack of opportunity. Okay, so I want to look at some other guys. Well, hold on. You before we started, wanted to talk about Tevin Jenkins, offensive lineman from Oklahoma State, went in the second round to Chicago, because this will tie into some of the second and third year players that we're going to talk about, specifically David Montgomery. So now Tevin Jenkins will be blocking for David Montgomery. I mean, what kind of, let's talk Montgomery. This is a guy who finishes number four back in PPR last year. Points per reception, for those who don't know. I do know that one. but I've seen a lot of people drafting him and putting him from a standpoint of around running back like 15 to 20. Like I don't see him being pegged as a top 10 running back despite what he did last season. Is this a situation where Tariq Cohen's back, so he's not getting as many opportunities? They're bringing in a quarterback, so it's going to, why is David Montgomery's projection and draft capital lower than what he did on the field from a fantasy standpoint last year?
Well, people didn't like him last year either, which is, you know, sometimes you get that narrative about a player and it's just your take, you're stuck in that take and you're not going to move from it. But yeah, I've seen plenty of Tariq Cohen's coming back, so that's going to affect him. Obviously, Justin Fields has that running upside, that rushing upside. So it could also affect him, but they seem to want to run the ball and control the game through Montgomery. So I don't have any problem drafting the RB15. I think there's no chance he does worse than that. And then if he does better, that's immediate ROI. You're getting return on your investment right out of the gate. So I like his ADP a lot right now. I think a lot of people are still trying to shy away from him just because they're take locked from last year. So
speaking of take locked, and I swear this is not my like OSU, I don't like OU guys or anything like that. Why do people always act like Joe Mixon is one of the best running backs to draft? Because I disagree.
I have a lot of thoughts about Joe Mixon and they don't even like, I have a lot of thoughts and it doesn't even touch him off the field. So first of all, Cincinnati's offensive line, people are like, oh, well, they worked on it and it got better. They replaced one starter and it's a dude that hasn't played a full game since 2015. So I don't know, like get bent. It didn't get better. It got another Band-Aid, and offensive lines have to work together and have to be a perfect cog system in order to be a strong offensive line. And Joe Mixon needs a strong offensive line. He doesn't have pass catching upside because they don't use him that way. And then he was losing goal line touches to Gio Bernard and everybody's, oh, Gio's gone. Well, it doesn't mean they're going to give them to Joe Mixon. He couldn't get in from the goal line. That's why they started giving it to Gio. So I'm just, yeah, but I think people bought in when he was a rookie and they just haven't given up.
Yeah. Narratives, early narratives are hard to break away from sometimes. You say, well, that we've seen this from a player, so we think he can do that. It's like, yeah, but after a while. Okay, a couple other players I want to talk about. First up, Jalen Hurts, former Oklahoma quarterback, going to be the starter for Philadelphia this year. It's his team now. Seeing him going as far as draft for round quarterback, 10, 11, 12, he's getting a lot of comps to your Kyler Murrays and your Lamar Jacksons and that style of player. I mean, what do you expect from Jalen Hurts? Would you draft him and where would you?
I am not taking him at price right now. And I have friends that are like, he's going to be a top five fantasy quarterback. And I love the optimism, but I can't get behind that. I'm not sold on the Eagles really as a whole. You know, people are in on Goedert. I'm not in on Goedert. I love Devontae Smith, but I don't know what he and Hurts are going to put together. And I wouldn't be surprised for them to turn around and draft a running back or a new quarterback next year. I think unfairly, I don't know that it's fair, but I think Jalen Hurts is going to have to put up or shut up this year because of the turmoil that they've gone through since winning a Super Bowl. And I say that as a Broncos fan who has been going through quarterback turmoil since we won a Super Bowl. Your patience gets real thin, real fast. And so I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't do well this year, that he's not the starting quarterback in 2022. And for that reason, I don't really target him in Dynasty, but I think he's got sneaky upside this year just because of his rushing floor. But I worry about longevity with Hurts.
Makes sense. All right, I'm going to wrap up on this. Two guys entering their second season had really rough year ones, mostly due to injury and a variety of other things that impacted their years. But Denzel Mims and Jalen Reagor. Mims, of course, from Baylor, now with the Jets, and Reagor, speaking of Philadelphia, from TCU, now with the Eagles. You know, these are two guys I think could be at worst the wide receiver two for both rosters. Looking at both of them, Where do you value both? Who do you like better and see as potentially having the better season this year?
Oh, man, I think Mims is still cheaper than Rager, and I still like Mims better. I like what they did this offseason. I like what the Jets put together this offseason. I like where that team is headed. And I think Mims has a really good chance of popping this year. So I can get him cheaper, and I have more faith in that offense. So that's where I'm going to gravitate towards.
Yeah, I think I agree. Rager's had injury issues at a certain point. We talked about develop reputation. He's got a reputation for being injured. Mims obviously got hurt. Then he had some family issues last year, never got things going. I'm curious with Zach Wilson, with a full offseason of being healthy, with some upgrades to that team. I just forgot the terrible head coach they just fired.
Adam Gase.
Thank you. The Gase effect, which once Gase leaves, everybody gets better, right? That's the whole idea. So I think I have Mims in at least one of my leagues, and I'm interested to see what he's one of those guys I was like, I wasn't going to drop him. You know, I drafted him. I think I'm going to give him a chance. I kind of like him better than Rager as well. I think Rager is a better upside talent. I just think, man, when you get to the NFL, situation matters so much. Like we said with Tylan. Like, I think if Tylan had gone to a team that was in need of wide receivers that had obvious playing time available, Tylan would have been a great dynasty pick. But situation matters and landing spot matters sometimes more than just who you are and your talent.
Yeah, absolutely. Talent matters to an extent, but at some point the team and coach and variables are going to affect you.
All right, Linda, let's do this. Who is one player that you are higher on than everybody else that you would say, go get him. Spend the money on him if you have to, but go get him. He's going to win you your league this year.
Oh, man. I'll go real
cheap. It can't be a kicker. No kickers.
I know. I won't. Just so we're here, I love kickers because my dad kicked at Oklahoma State. So it was like the whole, it encapsulates everything. But Justin Herbert, man. If anybody in your league is worried about a sophomore slump that has Justin Herbert, go in and get him. They beefed up that offensive line. They gave him another pass catching option in Josh Palmer. Eckler will be back this year. I think Herbert has serious the QB1 upside. Made a bet with a buddy that he scores more total points than Patrick Mahomes. So like, I'm in on Justin Herbert this year. I know that's like cheap because he's already pretty pricey, but if anybody feeds that sophomore slump, or use it as a selling point, you know, see if you can get somebody to buy it. But that's my guy.
Yeah, I drafted him in one of my dynasty leagues last year in like mid second round. I was like, I'm in a spot. Why, you know, I think I had the 206. I was like, why not? Let's go ahead and grab him because everybody was low on him. You can't pry him from my cold dead hands right Mm-mm. now. You can't afford him.
Exactly. Me too. Me yeah. too.
Yeah, you can't. You can't do it. Yes, on the Josh Palmer. I picked him up everywhere I can because I'm like, yeah, yes, please. Linda, this has been a lot of fun. I appreciate you joining us today. For everybody who wants to check out, and you do a fantastic job covering fantasy football, dynasty fantasy, redraft, all of it. You literally are doing mock drafts all the time. For those who are big fantasy football fans and want to see the work you do, where can they do so?
You can find me on Twitter at Lindellians, but really if you just search Linda and like add a football player to it, I'll probably pop up. And then Wednesday nights, me and a couple buddies do a show called Fantasy Football Confidential. And we talk everything from best ball to DFS to redraft to dynasty. So that's at 9 Eastern. And you can find that on Twitter at FF_confidential.
Linda, again, it's been a pleasure. And hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks.
Hey, everyone. This is Brady Trantham.
I'm Keegan Renault.
And we run the Inside OU podcast. Ever wonder what Lincoln Riley is up to?
Ever wonder what a leak route is?
What inexplicable loss did the Sooners suffer this time?
We cover that and more on the Inside OU podcast.
Every week, we drop a new episode on Thursday during the off season.
During the season, we bump it up to 2 times a week.
If that isn't enough for you, feel free to follow our Patreon page at Through the Keyhole for more in-depth Sooner and college football coverage.
Beat the rush, follow along on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Boomer.
Super Regionals get underway this weekend, and two Big 12 teams, of course, taking part, one of which is the Texas Tech Red Raiders. So very excited to have Keith of Red Raider Dugout of Dinger Derby podcast back with us again. Man, I said this last time, and I'll say it again. When it comes to like really super specific niche podcast things, I love you guys. You do a great job covering Texas Tech baseball.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's pretty specific. One school, one sport, but we're all in.
Hey, you know, sometimes it's easier. Sometimes it's easier. All right, so obviously it was a nice weekend for Texas Tech, going 3-0 in the Lubbock Regional, outscoring their opponents by a combined 21-7. And if I remember correctly, even of those seven, only five of those runs were earned. I think, I'm curious from you, my biggest takeaway was not that Texas Tech won. Like, it didn't surprise me that they won. I thought there would be a lot more offense in that regional. I think Texas Tech about lived up. I thought maybe they put up a few more runs, but I thought we'd see a few more runs from the opponents. But Texas Tech's pitching, what felt like for the first time all season, really locked in this past weekend.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, you saw the graphic today that was floating around Twitter. Tech had a 1.66 ERA. In the postseason so far. So that's second in the country behind the University of Texas. And, you know, it was always a fairly winnable regional, I think. And it doesn't hurt that the three knocked off the two on Friday night. North Carolina beat UCLA, and that kind of changed the complexion. It was the first time since 2016 that Tech faced all three teams in the regional. So that was a little different, but third sweep in a row. But yeah, I totally agree. One, on the power front, the Red Raiders have been a long ball team all year, and you had a weekend where you saw more than 300 home runs across college baseball. It, you know, is breaking records all over as far as what the power looks like walking into the postseason. And the Lubbock Regional really wasn't one of those, which we get that reputation with wind, with the size of our ballpark. Everybody wants to talk about how offensive it is, but yeah, Tech's pitching was really solid. We also had the wind blowing in pretty solid on Sunday, so that changed the look a little bit too. And the guys like Drew Baker and Cole Stillwell, you know, they really mashed some balls that normally would have been out of the yard at Danlaw Field that ended up just fly balls. And so that was part of that. But yeah, pitching locked in, and it was surprise changes. Chase Hampton, who got the start on Sunday against Kansas in the final series of the season, he came in and started on Friday night instead of Patrick Monteverdi, who moved to the Saturday game. And then Mason Montgomery started on Sunday, and Micah Dallas, who's been around for a while and been in the pen and a starter, goes back to the bullpen. And he's a really fiery guy, and he just acts like a closer. And that's how they used him. He got the save on Friday night against Army, came in to a 6-3 ball game, saved it in 11 pitches, and then came back in and did the final two innings of the regional championship game against UCLA, what ended up being an 8-2 ball game. And so, you know, finally, the Red Raiders, who've lost a one starter during the season and then other starters prior to the season, all to Tommy John, finally, you kind of find a mix and you get more bullpen pieces than just Ryan Sublette. And there have been other guys, but Ryan Sublette's kind of the go-to. And now you have Micah Dallas and a guy that can go twice in a weekend. It just changes the whole complexion of the team.
Looking ahead to this weekend, because that's what I want to spend most of our time on, you mentioned that the change in the rotation for Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Is that what you expect to see against Stanford this weekend, yeah, or could we see a changeup again?
I don't think he'll change it again. I'd be surprised. Now, it's funny, and you said you listened to our pod. George said that. You know, all of our friends and the Tech hecklers are a group that have been around since the mid-90s, and George and Gus are a part of that, and you know, in that group, nobody ever said Micah Dallas the closer. You know, we had no idea that was going to be the move that gelled everything up. But I would be surprised if he changed it. It worked great. It seemed like he liked them where they were. And so, and I think Chase Hampton, really all three of them are just pitching really well right now, Hampton and Montgomery especially. So I think that he'll most likely stick with it. We'll find out tomorrow after the practice in the post-practice availability.
So hold on a second. You have a group called the Tech Hecklers that you don't just call the Techlers? Like, it's sitting right there.
Yeah.
You say Techlers, which is a terrible term, but also if you're going to be a heckler, like, that feels an appropriate thing to do.
Yeah, I don't know if I can go with Techler. It's too close to Tickler. Yeah, there's a guy named Chris Sneed that's still in that group. Chris Sneed founded with a group of people, founded that in the 90s. And he actually wrote a book called The Bleacher Bible that has the 10 commandments of heckling. That's something a lot of people have seen. It floats around the internet, but really just a conglomeration of the best burns that he had heard. And man, they can really get deep. You know, they do some stuff that people don't see very often. And when you have like the Rangers tour comes around and those guys come back and they're like, yeah, I played in Lubbock in, you know, 2003 and you guys got me good, you know, that kind of stuff. It just adds to the whole atmosphere of the park. It's a lot of fun.
Bleacher Bible. I'm going straight to Amazon when we're done here to look that one up.
Yeah.
Okay. So continuing our look ahead to this weekend, before we talk about the games themselves, as we both have mentioned, I do listen to you guys' show and I listened to the most recent episode and I did not realize that there is a bit of a storied history here between Texas Tech and Stanford. You guys have a rich history against what used to be one of the top collegiate baseball programs back of the 90s and early 2000s. Can you kind of share some of that for everyone who's listening here?
Yeah, you bet. I mean, if there's one thing to know about Texas Tech for a non-fan, it's that if we play you, we hate you all the way around. And if you beat us, we hate you even more. And so that's that. When you talk about rivals and all that stuff with Tech, I mean, it's just hatred. That's just all there is to it. And so, you go back. Stanford was really the team of the 80s. They won two titles in the 80s. They were in the CWS almost every year. Team of the 90s, early 2000s. I mean, they've really been a power. They're a blue blood in college baseball. And in 1995, Tech had been on the rise. They'd hired a guy named Larry Hayes from Lubbock Christian. He won NAIA titles at Lubbock Christian University. They hired him in the 80s. He really pushed the program forward. In 1995, Tech makes its first regional. And so back then, there was 48 teams in the field, and then you had six team regionals. So six team regionals, the winner of the regionals, that's who goes to Omaha. And so Tech was a one seed in the Midwest One regional, which was at Wichita State. They seemed poised for maybe their first opportunity to go to Omaha. And it was their first postseason appearance. And so they, you know, just demolished Providence, by just a crazy margin. It was like 25-4, something like that. And then they turn around and beat their former SEC foe, Arkansas, 14-10. They beat Stanford 3-1, and you're thinking Stanford is, you know, going to be causing trouble there. They go into the loser's bracket, have to win their way back out, and then they win two in a row against Tech to knock them out and go to Omaha themselves. And so it was a 3-2 game. They won it on a RBI go-ahead single that I believe went through the wickets of a third baseman, and then and they pitched a complete game. And then Kyle Peterson, who was a freshman at the time, KP, for anybody that watches the College World Series, he's on the call of a lot of those games. He's the owner of D1Baseball.com also. He pitched a complete game as a freshman and beat Tech 6-5. And so I talked about it with Gus and George on our episode. I mean, I think there's still some bad blood in Lubbock because fan bases have long memories, especially Tech, I think. And I think there's still some people that don't like seeing KP on TV, you know, just for that loss, even though he's a really good dude. And so there's that history there. And then on February 22nd of 2020, Tech beat Stanford in Round Rock 7-2. And a ton of guys on both of these teams were in that game. That was probably the highlight of that shortened season. And it's kind of forgotten because of 2020. So on top of all of that, you know, and it was important history to Tech more so than Stanford, I think, although they did get to go to Omaha. You know, you put all that together and a team that's so hot as the Red Raiders have been the last 9 years under Tim Tadlock, and the all-time record then is 2-2. And so you've got a super regional, a chance to go to Omaha, and you're going to break the all-time tie, you know, between these two programs. So it's kind of the classic historic program and the new hotness, you know, in the Red Raiders. And it just adds another layer, you know, that's fun. And two teams that are pretty familiar. I mean, the majority of the guys that got extra base hits, actually all of them except for Dylan Noisy because of injury, they got extra base hits against Stanford last year, are playing on this team. And Tim Tawa, who hit the home run for the two runs that Stanford did score, he's, you know, starting on this team as well. And there's just a ton of guys crossing over. So should be a fun weekend and some competitive baseball in Lubbock.
New hotness. Love it. New hotness. Stanford, of course, winners of their Stanford regional. It took them a little bit longer than Texas Tech to get out. They lost the first time to UC Irvine in their regional championship and then won the second one, 11-8. So UC Irvine gave them a bit of a fight there. Now they head into the Logic, and look, I haven't paid close enough attention to Pac-12 baseball this season. Obviously Stanford's good, the 9 seed, hosting a regional, so they're not bad. But realistically, and feel free, I don't care. This is a Big 12 podcast, as I keep saying for some reason this episode, small J journalism, small, small, small. Like, if you want to put on your Texas Tech shaded lenses, that's fine. Looking at this series, I mean, I expect Texas Tech to come out of it and go to Omaha, especially if the pitching is what it was last weekend. I absolutely do. But I have seen a lot of people talk about it. This feels like it could be a high offense weekend. It could be a high offense series. I know the temperatures are going to be like a bajillion there in Lubbock when this every game first pitch at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, right in the nice heat of the day. I mean, what do you realistically expect from this series? Is it going to be a 2-game series, or are we going to go to 3?
Oh, that's a tough question. I don't know. I think you could absolutely go to 3, and most likely would if the Red Raiders can't get on Brendan Beck, the ace for Stanford. And this is a guy that's got a sub-1 whip at this point in the season. He's undoubtedly their ace. His last Pac-12 series, his start went a complete game, like 2-hitter. I mean, he's an impressive pitcher. If the Red Raiders can get on him, and I would assume he's the Friday starter. They held him till the second game in the Palo Alto regional. If they can get on him, then you have a good chance to go a couple. I would expect it to be a little more offensive. Stanford hit 9 home runs in their regional. Now they had 4 games to do it. Tim Tawa hit 4 of them. They've got 3 guys with double digit dingers. Tech has 3 guys with more than 13 home runs. Jace Young leading the way in that with 21, 20 or 21. I can't remember now, but I think that pitching is going to be the key. And if Tech's pitching is like it was last weekend, it's going to be a long road, as Mike Gustafson said, coming into Lubbock and trying to outslug the Red Raiders in their own ballpark is a tough way to win a Super. And Tech's not going to go down easily. They've been here 4 times, you know, and every time that they've been to this level, they've gone to Omaha. And so it's a tall road, I think, for Stanford. I don't think anybody needs to be cocky by any stretch of the imagination. They have great pitching in Brendan Beck. They have one of the nation's best closers. He's a side armor named Zach Gretsch. And so I think that that's an interesting combination. But then their other starters is the question. And that's how North Carolina came into the regional, with their coach just flat out saying, I don't have another starter. We'll figure it out. And so I don't think Stanford's at that point, but it is interesting not knowing exactly who the next guy up is. And then I do think, you mentioned the weather, it's got to be considered. I mean, in the last game of that Palo Alto regional, people were bundled up like it was February. I mean, it was 60 degrees in the Bay Area, and there were dozens of fans there. Sell out right now at Dan Lamar Griffin Park, and they add stands in the left behind left fields and temporary stands. Sell out right now is just shy of 4,800. I will tell you, they are rowdy. Saturday night was one of the rowdiest games that I've seen in that ballpark, and that's saying something. And it's going to be 108 on Friday. And so we saw in the 18 regional, Louisville came to town and they kind of turned their nose up at the heat, and they wore black unis in an afternoon game, and they absolutely got smoked by the heat. That turf will radiate at 130 plus. And so it can really mess with your mind, I think, out there. And of course, physically as well. So that's got to be something to consider, but also to say Texas Tech hasn't played in much of that. We've had a long spring. We just haven't had really even many 90s days, and now all of a sudden, boom, we're punched in the mouth with the hundreds this week. So it was about 102 or 104 today, and so opportunities for teams to kind of get out in it. But yeah, I mean, of course I do. I'm a little bit of a homer here. I expect Texas Tech to win. I don't think it's easy, but when you just look at pure numbers across these teams, the Red Raiders just look like a more offensive club. Maybe the pitching is a little bit more figured out if you look at last weekend. But Stanford's done some really impressive things offensively, and they've got like seven guys that are offensively interchangeable. And so I think that for them, you know, top to bottom, maybe they push you up and down the lineup a little more, but the Red Raiders have had a couple dudes come on kind of out of nowhere here late, and that's really made them dangerous 1 through 9 as well. So it should be a lot of fun. Nothing else, it should be good baseball. I don't expect it to be, you know, two blowout sweep ball games by any means. I think it's going to be hotly contested.
I mean, look, I think this is the more interesting of the supers for the Big 12. No offense to South Florida, but, you know, they've got a tall task against Texas. But I do think this one will be interesting. I can see this going 3. I do think Texas Tech gets out of Lubbock and heads back to Omaha again. Keith, man, it's always a pleasure.
I'll say
to
real
have
quick, I tweeted at Kendall Rogers last night, and people were tweeting at him like, what's the chance that, you know, this coach goes there, and he's just sending them percentages or better than 0 or whatever. And so I just said, what are the chances we're eating at the Drover in a couple of weeks or having a steak at the Drover? And he just said 70%, you know? So I think that, you know, again, you never go in overconfident, but when you just look at them side by side on paper, it seems pretty good. I will say that I've gone ahead and made hotel reservations. Now I do that every year, but I think that it's, I don't want to say likely, but I would say highly possible the Red Raiders come out ahead. But, you know, it's baseball. And like George said on our podcast, and that'll be my final thought if you're about done, but with me at least, you know, he said, Coach Hayes used to always say, it's not if you can do it, it's if you can do it again, you know? And so you got to come out of that regional and replicate those performances, you know, and keep the energy and keep the focus, and particularly from the pitching standpoint. And, you know, Drew Baker and Cal Conley combined to go 0-10 against UCLA. And John Savage mentioned that in the post game, saying, hey, look, these two studs just did that, and look what Texas Tech was still able to do to us. And so is Kurt Wilson still hot? Is Nate Rombach picking up? Is Parker Kelly stringing a few more hits together? Do Conley and Baker get rolling again? I mean, you know, where do you sit walking into those days? And then what is Brendan Beck able to do on Friday against this lineup? That's that in 108 degree weather, you know what, that's the big question.
Yeah. I am excited to watch a Les Supers. It's always a good time. Keith, man, it's always a pleasure. Do me a favor. For everybody who wants to check out the work you do covering Texas Tech baseball, where can they do so?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Red Raider Dugout. And then personally, I'm at Keith B. Patrick, and then just redraiderdugout.com. I've got recaps from all those regional games. And then I've got a super regional preview up, really just of Stanford. I kind of assume our fans know about our team. And then, as you said, we had a new podcast episode drop about midnight tonight or this morning. And so it's up and ready to go. Dr. Mike Gustafson is the executive director of the College Baseball Hall of Fame, and George Watson, a longtime newspaper guy from our area that's turned fan now. We just dig into this team. They have a ton of institutional and baseball knowledge, and I just kind of go along for the ride. So it's a lot of fun. And anybody wants to check it out or hear a little bit more about what we think we're going to see, just hop on in there. That's the Dinger Derby podcast. It's also at redraiderdugout.com and in all of your podcatchers.
Yeah, guys, go subscribe. If you're a Texas Tech fan, it's a great podcast. If you're not a Texas Tech fan, but you just are interested in collegiate baseball, it's a great show. I enjoy it. I don't listen to every episode, I'm going to be blunt, but I listen to a lot of them, and it's always a good time. So, Keith, man, I always appreciate you coming on the show. I think we might be able to get you on one more time, because I don't think this season is over for Texas Tech yet. I don't think so.
Well, one way or the other, I'd be happy to come on again. But, yeah, man, always enjoy talking ball, and thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
We're taking a unique spin in our Austin Super Regional. Texas taking on South Florida out of the American Conference. So we are very excited to have Nathan Bond of the Daily Stampede, the SB Nation South Florida site, joining us today for a little South Florida preview. Nathan, welcome to the 10-12, sir.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's start here. This is an amazing run by South Florida, because I don't think most people know about their season, and I didn't know a lot about South Florida in their baseball season until I really started doing some digging. This is a team that finished the regular season with a losing record. I believe they were 24-26, if my math is correct.
Correct.
And yet somehow they find themselves making a run through the American Conference Championship and winning that to get a slot into regionals. The 4 seed at Florida in Gainesville, where they go and win the whole dang thing, including beating Florida and Miami. And now they head to Austin to face the number 2 ranked Texas, based off your rankings, whichever one you wanted. They were the 2 seed overall in Super Regionals with, I mean, two wins away from a what would be a shocking College World Series appearance. I mean, I want to start with what is it, what has led to this complete and total, what feels like turnaround for South Florida?
I think at first you've just kind of got to chalk it up to Tampa Bay. Just the entire city of Tampa is just on an absolute heater over the last, what, 16 months or so. And USF baseball just caught fire at the right time. I mean, they start the season, they got swept by Florida Gulf Coast, I believe, twice in the first 2 weeks of the season. And it looked rough. They got swept by the middle school in Lubbock. It was not a good start to the year, but I think everyone would chalk up the turnaround to the final two games of the regular season versus ECU. They kind of clicked for them. They won those final two games and then just kind of honestly cruised through the conference tournament. And we're here, and it's a shock to every single USF fan, because this sort of thing doesn't happen to USF literally ever.
Yeah, it's wild. I mean, you get to the American Conference Tournament, you beat Wichita State 7-2, Tulane 5-0, run rule by Tulane, then come back, win 7-1, and then beat UCF in the championship series. I laugh because, you know, we did a bit of a draft about conference champions with the boys from College Baseball Nation, and none of us, the three of us, had UCF or USF in there, which was crazy. And then, I mean, I know the story of the Gainesville Regional with Florida just completely, I mean, for lack of a better term, shitting the bed at their own home regional in a very embarrassing fashion. But, I mean, USS is the four seed. We've seen four seeds make it out of regional play before, but it's very rare. Mm-hmm. This is just, I mean, it's a cool story. It's great. You know, you're saying things are clicking, and that's really interesting, and congrats to your Buccaneers. But, like, who are the guys that you've seen maybe have things click for the most that we should be paying attention to in Austin this weekend?
Let's start with the pitching. I mean, as Jack Jasiak goes, so do the rest of the Bulls. He's a redshirt freshman. He looked great last season in the COVID shortened year, and kind of he came back and worked on his body. Coach Moll said he worked on his body to, you know, just be in better shape after his outing at the middle school in Lubbock. Just kind of got torched, figured it out, and it's just been kind of lights out since then. And then the rest of the starting pitcher, Dylan Burns, Colin Sullivan. Colin Sullivan, I think, is a six-year senior. Dylan Burns, I think, is a six-year senior. I think Dylan, before I even started covering USF, was already at USF. Like, he had already made his debut before I started covering USF athletics. Like, it's just one of those things where it just kind of kept going, and it's just another incredible run. Orion Kirkring out of the bullpen has been fantastic. Joe Sanchez came in, shut it down. The lefty, another lefty to keep an eye on is Logan Lyle. He proved just amazing for most of the regional and in the conference tournament. It's just incredible. And then hitting, your 1-2-3 guys are what you really want to look out for. Carmine Lane, Riley Hogan, and Roberto Pena all have 10-plus home runs. And then there's this little spark plug, this guy who basically saved the day for USF to clinch the regional versus South Alabama, Jared Eaton, 7-hole hitter. He may be 5'8", 170, sopping wet. He had three RBIs. And it was just one of those things where, you know, they're down 2-0 to South Alabama in the elimination game. He hits a bases loaded double, a ground rule double. But if the wall was like 4 feet higher, 3.5 feet higher, it's a triple, and it's a bases clearing triple. And it's just like one of those things where, as a USF fan, you are just so scarred from literally every single sport just getting shafted. You're like, okay, well, that's just going to cost them the game now because they couldn't get the triple. Nick Gonzalez getting a home run robbed, two-run homer robbed in left field. It's just like those things just kept mounting. And then for some reason, it flipped. And shout out to Billy Moll and what I've talked to him about, the Clearwater being the house of horrors for USF baseball, figuring it out this postseason.
It's wild, man. It's I love the, I guess I for sure continue to call them the Olympic sports, and I know baseball's not technically, but it's so wild to me seeing teams that aren't our usual, you know, college football teams. Right. South Florida has college football, but I mean, your perennial powers, you really get in the sports like baseball, softball, soccer, things of that nature. You get to have teams who make truly magical runs or do things that are really wild, just because there's a little bit more of an even playing field. Now that said, South Florida is heading to Austin. Texas is the 2 seed. They're one of the best teams in the country, obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, realistically, and it's okay if you want to put on your USF shaded green lenses for me. That's okay. We're a podcast, not, you know, small J journalism. What do you think are USF's realistic chances here in Texas? Is this something where if they can just show up, you guys feel good as a fan base? If they could get a win, it would be the best thing ever. What are your realistic expectations? And what do you think would be perceived as a successful trip to Austin for South Florida fans?
I think a successful trip to Austin would be not having the same faith that UConn had against Notre Dame last weekend or Florida had against South Alabama. Keep it respectable, right? I mean, Texas is one of the best teams in the country for a reason. Their pitching is outstanding. I mean, having 3 starters with a sub-3 ERA, one of them with like a 1.41 ERA, like those don't grow on trees. And USF doesn't hit the ball terribly well. They weren't great in the regional. They just had very, very timely hitting. So I would make no bones about, you know, USF going 2-2 here. But I mean, regardless, this is all gravy. They won a conference championship for the first time since 1995. They won a regional for the first time, literally ever. Okay. So whatever happens this weekend, so be it. This has been such a fun run with this baseball team over the last two and a half weeks that whatever happens, and we'll be happy either way.
Yeah. That's what we call playing.
But it'd be great if we beat them. Exactly.
For those who don't realize, Texas won their regional 3-0 by a combined score of 33-5. Not that Austin was a stacked regional by any metric whatsoever. However, you know, Texas is pretty good this year. Well, man, Nathan, I appreciate you taking some time out of your day to come on and talk a little South Florida. Do me a favor. I know you guys and pretty much everybody who works at various SB Nation sites do a great job. But for those interested in checking out your coverage of the Bulls, maybe getting a little bit of the opponent's perspective ahead of this weekend's regional, where can they do so?
Yeah, you can check us out at thedailystampede.com. Our house account on Twitter is at StampedeSBN, or you can follow myself at Bulls Nathan SBM. We'll have 2 riders on the ground in Austin, so that'll be fun to get that unique experience, get some Franklin barbecue. I think one of our riders already gathered enough people to do a go-ahead order at Franklin so they don't have to wait in the line. They, you know, work smarter, not harder. That's our motto. So it'll be a fun weekend.
All right. Well, Nathan, good luck to your Bulls. They're going to need it, and I mean that in the best way possible. And thanks again, man. Enjoy the games this weekend.
All right. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me on.